I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. President Trump has picked quite a fight with his own Justice Department and the FBI. Against strenuous opposition from the intelligence community who fear that sources and methods will be compromised, the president is encouraging the release of a memo prepared by Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee. The memo could be released later today, but the committee voted not to release a memo that Democrats have prepared to rebut the Republicans. We'll talk about these latest developments with David Smith of The Guardian and Don Lee of the Los Angeles Times. Plus, the celebrated playwright Eugene O'Neill's autobiographical play, A Long Day's Journey Into Night, opens this evening at the Everyman Theater. Deborah Hazlett stars. She joins me in Studio A. First, the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, it's the Midday News Wrap. The big news today is the release of a memo prepared by staffers for Republican members of the House Intelligence Committee. It was released just within the last 8 or 9 minutes. The FBI and the Justice Department are strongly opposed to making this memo public. President Trump is eager to have it released. Devin Nunes, the committee chair, also wants it made public, despite refusing to share it with his counterpart, Richard Burr, who heads the Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian involvement in the 2016 campaign. This all comes after news that Robert Mueller is negotiating with the president's lawyers to interview President Trump in connection with his investigation, Mr. Mueller's investigation. In an 80-minute State of the Union address on Tuesday night, the president touched on a long list of issues, including trade. A little later in our news wrap, we'll talk about the future prospects for NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and other economic issues with Don Lee, who covers economic matters for the LA Times. But first, we want to talk about this memo that has just been, as I said, just been released literally within the last few minutes. This from the Washington Examiner. The House Intelligence Committee released it. And of course, this was after a 5-day grace period in which President Trump was given the opportunity to restrict its release or refuse its release. He decided not to take up that opportunity when the House Intelligence Committee voted on party lines. And of course, it's controlled by the Republicans. So the Republican majority voted to release this confidential memo that has, according to many people in and outside of the intelligence community, a number of sensitive intelligence issues intertwined with it. President Trump was given this memo, I guess, on Wednesday and given 5 days to decide whether or not it could be released. He did allow it to be released, and the House Intelligence Committee then is the one that's officially releasing. So this has come out, as I said, just within the last few minutes. One of the big issues in contention here is this so-called Steele dossier. Christopher Steele, the British intelligence agency, who was hired by people opposed to Mr. Trump during the campaign, both Republicans and Democrats. And the memo confirms that the dossier formed an essential part of the initial and all three renewal FISA applications against Carter Page. So this was a central issue in this dispute. Carter Page, the assistant to Mr. Trump, the advisor to Mr. Trump on things Russian during the campaign, surveilled Mr. Page, and they surveilled Mr. Page on several occasions under this FISA rule. And the justification for getting the FISA approval, the court that approves the ability of the FBI to surveil citizens, came based in part, at least, on information in this Steele dossier. We should mention that Democrats claim that the countervailing arguments that are made and put forth in this Republican memo are, number one, not being released because the Republican-controlled committee has voted not to release them. They're only releasing the Republican side, not the Democratic side. And Adam Schiff, the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, says, look, in order to refute the claims made in the Republican version of this memo, we would have to have classified information released, and we can't do it, so our hands are tied. So it's a very sticky wicket, and we want to take this up with David Smith. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian newspaper. He joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. David, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. So I don't know if you've had a chance to glance at the memo released by the House Intel Committee. I have not. I've had a chance to very quickly grab a sort of summary of it from the Washington Examiner, but it's literally, I think it was released like 15 minutes ago at this point. Have you had a chance to look at it?
No. The latest I'm aware of is that the president decided to declassify it and is obviously aware of suggestions that it will be critical of Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, and so on. But I've certainly not had a chance to pore over the document itself.
Sure. Well, let's back up a step and talk about the implications of this. The people in the White House are saying that the release of this document will allow people to see that there was some degree of bias or prejudice in the FBI as they were investigating the Trump campaign and its possible connections to Russia. What are the arguments that they're making in that regard?
They're claiming that Carter Page, a foreign policy advisor to Donald Trump, who I've met a few times, was put under surveillance and wiretapped, for reasons of bias, that he was under suspicion because of this infamous dossier produced by Christopher Steele, the former British agent. And that was spurious. Now, Democrats and others would argue that's a misleading claim because actually Carter Page had meetings with Russians prior to the Steele dossier. But, you know, they're saying it's evidence of political bias within the FBI against the Trump campaign. And it's really necessary to get as much transparency and, as Paul Ryan said, sort of cleanse the institution and see it for what it is. And clearly, critics would say the much bigger backdrop to that is trying to discredit the FBI and indeed Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into alleged collusion with Russia.
And of course, regardless of what the motivations may or may not be, people in the intelligence community were very concerned that because of what this memo omits, the stuff that it can't talk about or won't talk about, chooses not to talk about, denudes this memo of context, and that it could also very easily jeopardize a lot of government information, including the methods and sources with which intelligence is gathered around the world. What's the latest on that? Has that argument been addressed by Devin Nunes, the chair of the committee, or anybody in the White House?
Not very convincingly, I don't think. I mean, certainly that argument is being made loudly by Democrats such as Adam Schiff. They make the point that this is a four-page document and therefore will be a very partial and selective account. And normally you would expect a full account to be more like 60 pages. And clearly, Nunes insists that it contains relevant information and it's important, but Democrats say, he even edited it, after they saw it and before it went to the White House. Again, that will be a battleground. Whether the document is worthy and has merit, or is just, I think the phrase that is being used by many of its critics is that it's cherry picked, and remains to be seen if, for example, Christopher Wray of the FBI will resign over this. And interestingly, one strand is, according to several media reports, one of the worries the White House has is that when it actually is publicly widely seen and digested, that it will be a bit of a damp squib after all this build-up and all this hype. Actually, the contents will not be that interesting and not that explosive, and they're wondering, is it really worth alienating the FBI over this?
And it's central to it appears to be the importance, the significance of this so-called Steele dossier. Christopher Steele, the British intelligence agent who was hired by various people, and including the FBI, to look into the Trump campaign's connections to Russia. What do we know at this juncture now, you know, some 2 years after Mr. Steele started sniffing around? What do we know about the credibility of the items that Mr. Steele put in this now famous dossier?
And yes, I think one of the important points there that Nunes and the Republicans are trying to allege is that the Steele dossier was funded by Democrats at least in part of its life, and that's why they claim the FBI was wrong to surveil Carter Page. But to answer your question more generally, I think the Steele dossier is still very much in play. The jury is still out in the sense that the vast majority of it has neither been proved nor disproved, really. And yet again, as with so much, this tends to fall down on partisan lines. And if you're a Trump defender, you would say, look, some of these outrageous claims, including, you know, what happened that night in a hotel in Moscow, there is still not a shred of evidence to prove. But if you're a Trump critic, you would say, well, actually, as time has gone on, the dossier still resonates. There's still a lot in there that has not been disproven, and I think ultimately a lot is going to hinge on Mueller's investigation before sort of history makes a judgment on that dossier. But certainly, I think many people have come to the conclusion that Christopher Steele himself is a distinguished and generally reliable agent, and many of his defenders would say he was actually taking a greater interest in defending U.S. national security against Russia than now many Republicans are.
Of course, the other issue here is very intriguing. There are three separate investigations going on in the Congress and the Senate, in addition to Robert Mueller's Office of the Special Counsel, the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, as well as the House Intelligence Committee, which, as we mentioned, is chaired by Devin Nunes and who made the decision just minutes ago to release this memo. However, Mr. Nunes seemed quite interested in making sure that the memo became public this afternoon, but refused to share it with, for example, his counterpart in the Senate, on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Burr, who asked to see it and wanted to know about it. Lindsey Graham thought it was a good idea to at least have the Senate Intel Committee take a look at it, although he was one of the Republicans, along with John Thune, who were very skeptical about the need to release it. But what do you make of the fact that here we have the House and the Senate not playing well in the sandbox together over an issue like this?
I think it points to a wider malaise in that what should be independent investigations are being tainted by personalities and politics all the way. I mean, I suppose if you wanted to be an optimist, you could try to say, well, actually, it's a good thing that the House and Senate committees are keeping some separation from each other and keeping a firewall between each other. And you know, if they shared too much, then, you know, what's the point of running them separately? But I think the reality is that there's been concern for some time that the House committee in particular is not getting anywhere fast with this entire investigation, that it's just become too bogged down in partisan politics. And when you have the Democrat Adam Schiff sort of at war really with some of his Republican counterparts, we don't have great faith in that committee really getting to the bottom of this. The Senate one maybe a bit more, but just as a journalist covering this issue generally, we find that the congressional committees are really on the back seat and something we don't write about much on reporting this story, and that really Robert Mueller, the special counsel, is dominating the landscape. You know, that's the investigation that has brought indictments, has seen the likes of Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn actually in court, that seems to be really setting the pace and really, I think, is the, you know, for the outside world, Mueller is the one people are looking to, and the congressional ones are sort of now somewhere in the background.
What do you think, having covered this in your paper, your colleagues at The Guardian covered this now for quite a while, what do you think this memo's capacity to attenuate trust and credibility or trust and believability in the FBI and the Justice Department will be? Do you think it will succeed in gaining more supporters for Mr. Trump's claims that the, you know, investigation into the Russia situation is a hoax and a witch hunt?
No, I think like so many of his tweets, it will probably just see both sides digging in deeper in their respective trenches. Clearly, Fox News and other right-wing media and many Republicans who are all in for Trump will use it as a propaganda tool and weaponize it and argue that it does delegitimize and discredit Mueller, the FBI, the judiciary apparatus. And meanwhile, on the other side, liberals, Democrats, MSNBC will argue the opposite and say that it's partisan politics and is being politicized. And you know, that, I think, is the fundamental worry, the attack on institutions that will be needed again in future. I think in the last hour, Senator John McCain, for example, you know, put out a statement saying that all of this is bad for the presidency, you know, bad for the FBI, bad for American institutions, and the real winner is Vladimir Putin and Russia just watching you know, Americans at each other's throats, and you know, he's kind of, you know, laughing behind his hand at it. So I think it will just sort of deepen a divide that's already there, but you know, there won't be many people who you know, cross sides from one to the other.
You mentioned the prospect of Christopher Wray, the Trump-appointed director of the FBI. Mr. Trump appointed him when he fired James Comey last year. There are even some White House officials who fretted about the possibility of Mr. Wray resigning over this issue of the White House's decision to release the memo. We don't know one way or the other whether that's going to happen, although it seems in the last 24 hours or so that people are not glomming on to that theory as a likelihood. But Andrew McCabe, his deputy, the deputy director of the FBI, who is part of this memo, actually, has retired earlier than was expected that he do so. What do you make of that? You wrote about Mr. McCabe. This had to do with his wife and some political contributions that she received when she ran for a state office in Virginia. How do you think the significance of Mr. McCabe's decision will play into this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's true he was going to retire anyway, but the sustained attacks from Donald Trump certainly didn't help. I was at the White House briefing that day, and of course, the press secretary, Sarah Sanders, insisted that Trump had played no part in it, and it was purely a decision for McCabe and the FBI. Whether that will have an impact on Wray and what happens next, I'm not so sure. I mean, generally, in this entire era of the Trump administration, it's folly to make predictions. I would hate to guess whether Wray is going to be gone by tonight or still be in position, you know, 5-10 years from now. But I think it, and you know, today, of course, Trump has tweeted trying to pledge support for the rank and file in the FBI, but attacking the leadership of both the FBI and judiciary. And so I think a lot depends on whether someone like Christopher Wray feels it's just untenable and he'll make more of a political statement by going, or you know, as is the ethical dilemma for so many in the Trump administration, do they feel there's actually a better role to play by sticking it out and when necessary standing up to him. And you only have to look at someone like Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who one minute we think he's leaving, the next he's not. Certainly has a bad relationship with Trump on a personal level, but nevertheless is is sticking it out. And of course, Rex Tillerson is another one. So it's all extremely hard to predict what will happen.
Yeah, common wisdom was that Mr. Tillerson would be out by the 3rd of January, and that, of course, has not happened. You also wrote about Mike Pompeo, the head of the CIA, former Tea Party congressman from Kansas, I guess. He talked not only about the Russia threat, which he predicted would again be present in the midterm elections coming up in November of this year, but he also pointed to China as perhaps an even bigger threat when it came to cybersecurity and election meddling, etc. I was fascinated by this on a number of levels. Number one, why do you think Mr. Pompeo decided to give an interview to the BBC a few days ago? What motivated him to come out and start talking like this? This is a guy who is not known for engaging with the press very much.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I wish he'd talked to us instead at The Guardian. But I guess clearly the BBC is a big international broadcaster, and it was a way to get his message across internationally. Perhaps he felt with the BBC's reputation for neutrality and also being a broadcaster, it would be less open to misinterpretation than what he might view as potential bias in an organization such as the New York Times or Washington Post if he listens to his boss's attacks. And the Pompeo phenomenon is very interesting. You know, he's walking this tremendous tightrope of his boss being clearly extremely critical of the intelligence community, and yet most of that fire has been concentrated on the FBI, and Pompeo's CIA has escaped relatively scot-free. Even more exquisite dilemma is the whole Russia question, where just going back to the Nunes memo and everything we've been talking about. The big picture backdrop is Donald Trump's very strange relationship with Russia and Vladimir Putin, and his consistent refusal to ever utter a word of criticism, and yet somehow Pompeo manages to square that circle where he acknowledges the intelligence community's finding that Russia did interfere in elections and could do so again. And yet is one of Donald Trump's favorites and briefs him regularly and is even tipped as a future Secretary of State. And so, again, sort of Pompeo managed to have his cake and eat it in that interview where he did warn that Russia could be a threat again in the midterm elections, and even though we've seen the White House doing virtually nothing about that. But as you note, he also warned of China potentially as a bigger threat, which would probably have pleased Trump. And let's face it, that's not an unreasonable thing to say. In that, one would be very surprised if China was not pursuing activity on the internet that some might regard as dangerous.
And of course, Director Pompeo said the Chinese have a much bigger footprint upon which to execute that mission than the Russians do. So Pompeo talked about the capacity of China being far greater than the capacity of Russia. And we've seen the kind of mischief that Russia's already been able to cause. Lord knows what might happen if China put its full force behind those same kinds of efforts.
Yeah, it makes complete sense, doesn't it? And I don't have the information to hand, but I sort of vaguely recall over the last few years, even during the Obama administration, covering one or two stories about certainly Chinese intellectual property theft via the internet. But I'm sure there already a sort of reasonable body of allegations of espionage. And yes, while Russia should never be underestimated, from the space race onwards, and terrific mastery of IT and computer systems and so on, clearly China as the rising global power, and I think now running a supercomputer faster than anyone in the US, and just sheer weight of numbers in terms of its population and its IT expertise, it would be somewhat surprising if they were not posing a threat on that front, given their rivalry with the US in so many areas.
And of course, it's not just the president's reluctance to say anything bad against Russia or to join the intelligence community's opinion that they did, in fact, meddle in the 2016 elections. But Congress and Senate overwhelmingly passed sanctions against Russia, which Mr. Trump has refused to enforce. So it goes past just rhetoric. It really actually goes to actions where it appears that Mr. Trump is doing at least some taking some action to appease the Russians, and all of this in the context of a Monmouth poll that just came out that says that Mr. Trump's approval rating is now at 42%. That's 10 points higher than it was a month ago when they asked about Mr. Trump's approval rating. He had this State of the Union speech on Tuesday night that you and your colleagues covered. He came up with a turn of phrase, Americans are dreamers too, that a lot of his supporters glommed on. You were quick to point out, you and many others, that the phrase that he used, the new American moment, was a phrase that Hillary Clinton had used as a Secretary of State back in 2010. But how do you think the president did on Tuesday in terms of not only firming up the supporters that were with him before the speech, but perhaps gaining some new ones?
It was an alternative reality speech. It was, hard to believe this was the same president who has been widely accused of sexism and racism and actively deepening the divisions that currently exist in the U.S., not to mention the shadow of the Russia investigation and so on. I think he did well in his own terms and for the Republican Party and for the base and did very little for those who oppose him, for Democrats, for minorities, for many women across the country. The political commentator Van Jones remarked it was candy, but it had poison in it, and I think that was quite a good description. And for me, as a reporter, we get to sit behind the president's head, sort of up high in the gallery. So we see something very different from television. It's actually quite hard to see Trump himself, and Paul Ryan and Mike Pence are invisible to us. But what you do get from that perspective is a grand vista of the House chamber itself, with all the Republican and Democrat House and Senate members and the Supreme Court justices. And I found that quite instructive, just as a vivid illustration of the divide in America today, because the Republicans cheered and whooped and clapped regularly and one even waved a Make America Great Again hat. But, from the moment Trump walked in, the Democrats just sat riveted to their seats, stony-faced, and one member, I don't know her name, she actually even conspicuously sat reading a newspaper when the president walked in, and Kirsten Gillibrand was studying her cell phone. And throughout, they had this dilemma of when to clap or when not to, and mostly they didn't. Even the line about African American unemployment being low, only one member of the Black Caucus that I could see rose to applaud that. And when the speech ended, the Democrats couldn't get out of there fast enough. They yeah. bolted from their seats for the exits, and I think that illustrated that the speech would not have succeeded in recruiting any new supporters.
And Lord knows what that will mean for discussions about things like immigration in these next few weeks. But we will, of course, keep our eye on it. David Smith is the Washington bureau chief for the Guardian newspaper in London. David, I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Quick break, and when we return, LA Times correspondent Don Lee joins us. We're going to talk Trump and trade. We'll take your calls and comments if we have time. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on our program, on the heels of Sunday's Super Bowl, a look at the big game's ads and what's ahead for the business of advertising. My guest will be Andrew Essex, the author of a fascinating book called The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die and the Creative Resurrection to Come. If you're just joining us today, it is the Midday News Wrap. We're going to shift gears now to the latest economic news. Don Lee joins me on the phone. He's a Washington-based reporter for the LA Times. He was, prior to that, the paper's bureau chief in Shanghai. Don, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Tom.
So you've been covering NAFTA. They've had six rounds of talks so far. The president, as a candidate, was railing against it, has continued to rail against NAFTA as a terrible deal since he's taken office. Where do things stand?
Well, this week they just concluded the sixth round, as you said, and they met in Montreal. And, you know, the fifth round was in Washington, and it was a very contentious round. The U.S. put its core proposals on the table. The Canadians and Mexicans did not like what they saw, and they had exchanged harsh words. But in Montreal this past week and last week, I think they began to make some progress, and the sides decided to continue to talk. And so I think they're going to be meeting again in late February in Mexico City, and things look a little more hopeful. And as you might have noticed, you know, President Trump didn't mention NAFTA in the State of the Union address. He didn't repeat his threat to withdraw from the, you know, 24-year-old pact. So there may be signs that that there could be compromises here, but we'll have to see.
I know one of the thorny issues that you've written about is the parts that go into automobiles and how much are required to be made in North America before they can be shipped over to Mexico or to Canada to perhaps assemble cars. And these are cars not only by American manufacturers, but Japanese, Korean manufacturers. Where are they at the moment? Where are the two sides sitting on that issue?
Well, as you mentioned, NAFTA has certain rules that allow cars that are made in North America to be traded among Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. duty-free if 62.5% of the contents of the vehicle are made in one, two, or three of those countries. And so the U.S. wants to increase that to 85%. And the thinking there is that if you raise the North American content requirement, then these North American manufacturers would not bring in and use parts from Asia primarily. And, you know, the focus is really on Mexico because it has opened a number of plants. Automakers in the U.S. and from Europe and Asia have opened plants in Mexico, and where labor is cheaper, and they've been sending, you know, parts to different places, and they're producing assembling cars there as well. And so I think the U.S. really wants to raise the overall content. But, you know, the U.S. also wants to do something different, add a new provision of having 50% of the vehicle's content that could go in duty-free to be made in the United States. And this is something that Canada and Mexico have balked at, and I think this latest round, Canadians proposed a way of measuring content that would include, you know, R&D and other measurements that are not just the value of these specific products. And so that didn't go over too well with the U.S. side. And so we'll have to see if they can find common ground there.
Mr. Trump also singled out washing machines and solar panels for tariffs. He's proposed a 20% or instituted a 20% tariff on washing machines and a 30% tariff on solar panels. Where does that come from, and what's the effect going to be?
Well, the washing machines, the tariffs start at 20%, go all the way up to 50%. The target there are washing machines, large residential washing machines from South Korea, from Samsung and LG. They've entered the market in recent years, and they've done quite well bringing in parts and actually of washing machines from different parts of Asia. And Whirlpool, which brought the complaint, had complained about Samsung and LG shifting their production from one Asian country to another to avoid tariffs. And so With these new tariffs that were announced, Samsung and LG will find it very hard to, send their goods at those prices. As far as solar panels are concerned, the latest tariffs actually follow tariffs that were enacted in the Obama administration. And because of those tariffs and just the price differential, there are very few solar panel makers in the U.S. Most of the panels are made in China and elsewhere, and the result is that the solar industry here believes that it's really going to hurt the installers and thousands of jobs, and so the effect could actually create a net loss of U.S. jobs because we're not actually making very many solar panels here, but we have people employed installing them.
The president has not saved his ire when it comes to trade for just Mexico, Canada, and Asia. He also had some things to say about the European Union. He described their trade laws as very unfair and intimated that in the future there could be some pretty serious arguments by a bloc in Europe that has traditionally been a close ally of the United States. What do you make of that, and what did he say?
Well, the U.S. has a trade deficit with most countries, and it has a sizable trade deficit with Germany, and the Trump administration is trying to reduce or even reverse these deficits with every major trading partner. And the U.S. and the EU have been negotiating a free trade deal under the Obama administration, and that has since been put on ice. And I think, just as with Asia, the Trump administration wants to, get tough with trade and wants to see more market openings and wants to reduce the trade deficit. And so I think, there's going to be continued contention there, and so we'll have to see just how much focus he puts on that. I do think NAFTA and then China will be the primary focus for the near term.
And Don, we just have less than a minute left, but I wonder, when it comes to all of these trade deals, TPP, which the Trump administration decided to withdraw from, and any other deals that might be made with the EU or NAFTA in particular, what is the evidence that, for example, NAFTA has, or what is the evidence about NAFTA in terms of it leading to a loss of American jobs?
Well, I think there have been different studies. Congress has the Congressional Research Service and other bodies have done research, and on net, the overall economic effect has not been that big. And so trade deals have created jobs, but it's also resulted in lost jobs for particular industries and segments of the workforce and areas in the country. So if you happen to be, making socks or apparel and textiles, and in certain low-wage industries, as well as in steel and other industries where countries have put a lot of investments in, I think people have clearly lost jobs, and some of these were very high-wage jobs, and so I think that's where people in the Midwest and elsewhere have felt a fair amount of pain. And so I think on the whole, even though there might not have been a lot of net job loss, those who have lost jobs will tell you that it's been quite a lot and painful.
Don Lee covers the U.S. and global economies for the Los Angeles Times. He's based in Washington. Don, thanks for your time. I appreciate it, sir, and we'll talk again soon.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
Coming up after the break, a conversation with one of our region's finest actors. Deborah Hazlett is currently starring in the Everyman Theater's production of A Long Day's Journey Into Night. We'll talk about this iconic play when we come back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.